You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda, your co-host, also in Washington, D.C. How's it going, Katie?
It's going great. Today, Ankit and I are very excited to welcome to the podcast Joel Witt. He is a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center and a former U.S. State Department official. He's the author of Fallout, the inside story of America's failure to disarm North Korea, which comes out a little later this month on October 28th. Welcome to the podcast, Joel.
I'm glad to be here.
We're so excited to have you and to talk about your book. It has a lot of juicy revelations in it, which I think people who are regular listeners of this podcast will find interesting. As someone, Joel, who was intimately involved with U.S.-North Korea policy, particularly during the Clinton administration, and deeply engaged in the issues since then, what was the most surprising revelation for you that came to the surface as you were writing this book?
Well, that's a tough question.
Got to start with the hard ones.
You know, I guess the most surprising one was I didn't realize how close Trump came to a successful summit in Hanoi. And I say that because, first of all, I had no idea that there was a multi-page summit document ready for signature that resolved almost every issue that the United States and North Korea had been dealing with for decades. And the only thing left was, of course, our favorite issue, denuclearization, and then how much sanctions lifting would go, you know, along with that. And, you know, I did a lot of interviews on the summit, and I talked to a lot of people who were there. But even if you read John Bolton's book very closely, you could see there was a moment when he almost panicked because Trump and Kim were close to a deal. So I think that was a big revelation for me.
Now, why do you think that Bolton was panicking about that moment? For maybe listeners who are less familiar with what happened in Hanoi, realize that it failed, but you know, what was the politics behind that?
Well, of course, you know, for those of us who have followed this issue, we know all about John Bolton, and he had a decades-long position that he didn't want any agreements with North Korea. He was much more interested in a military option.
Well, he's the father of the North Korean nuclear program, after all, right, Joel?
Yes, and that's good of you, Ankit, to bring that up, because that's what the North Koreans called John Bolton when we'd meet with them. Mm. He was the father of the nuclear program because he was part of the cabal that destroyed the 1994 agreement we had with North Korea to essentially denuclearize. So for decades, he had been against an agreement, and it was kind of a shock that he was part of a Trump administration with a president who wanted an agreement. And, you know, I guess another revelation for me was that, you know, there's this myth that John Bolton almost single-handedly undermined President Trump, when in fact, for most of the Trump administration, he was cut out of decision-making because everyone knew he didn't want an agreement.
Yeah. So, Joel, I'll confess that I haven't yet had a chance to work through the book, and I apologize for that, and it's definitely top of my reading list. But I wanted to ask you something that you probably struggled with having to finalize this manuscript at the time you did. Which is the changing geopolitics vis-a-vis kind of North Korea's relationship primarily with Russia. And, you know, this is a fairly recent development, accelerated. I mean, it's been ongoing since 2019, since after Hanoi when Kim and Putin met for the first time. But since 2023, things have really taken a different turn. And I wanted to ask you this because, you know, your professional experience dealing with the North Koreans came at a unique moment of geopolitical vulnerability for Pyongyang. The Soviet Union had collapsed. It was the post-Cold War world. The North Koreans were arguably in a vulnerable position for many reasons having to do with their sources of external support, the transition from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il. Today, I mean, Kim Jong-un, I think, sees a very different world, right? I mean, North Korea is a country that's navigated these periods of geopolitical change. The Sino-Soviet split, I think, is a really good example of that in their own history. So reflecting on kind of where we are today with the North Koreans, how much do you think this changed geopolitical context in Northeast Asia, Russia-North Korea ties, changes the picture from kind of what we'd been dealing with from the early 90s onwards all the way through to Hanoi, I guess?
Well, yeah, it's a big change. I mean, one of the driving factors behind their policy for, I guess, 30 years was the idea of counterbalancing China and reaching out to the United States to counterbalance countries around them that they were concerned about.
Yeah.
So obviously, this has changed dramatically now. And, you know, if there is another summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un, and there, I guess that's a possibility at the end of this month, it's just going to be very different, because I think Kim Jong-un was serious in Hanoi and at the DMZ about moving down the road to denuclearization. Today, it's not even possible. And so what I would say is Trump needs to be very careful in dealing with Kim today, because Kim is going to be pushing for steps on Trump's part to withdraw the United States from Northeast Asia.
Yeah, so I fully concur with that. I mean, in the old days when the North Koreans would talk about denuclearization, there was always conditionality. If the hostile policy goes away, et cetera, we might move towards denuclearization. Today, it's totally categorical on their part that they will keep their nuclear weapons. I believe Kim 2023 said, even if you sanction us for 1,000 years, we'll keep our nuclear weapons. So is that your view? I mean, this has been something that I think has been argued for a while, but has been difficult for people to kind of get around to, this idea that the North Koreans are going to keep their nukes. Is that where we are now? Is that the analytical reality that should contour the way in which the U.S., South Korea, and even Japan think about their policy towards the North Korean government?
Yeah, absolutely. They're not going to give them up, not in the foreseeable future. So all we need to be doing is to hold on to that as an objective. I think we can certainly hold on ourselves. But at the same time, the priority is to lessen tensions in the region, to avoid what may become a nuclear war, and to deal with the immediate challenges.
Now, I want to turn back a little bit to how we got to this moment. So a lot of the circumstances have changed, but this is, you know, a decades long saga of trying to denuclearize North Korea or prevent North Korea from achieving nuclear weapons. And there have been sort of these periods of time, these moments in time. You mentioned the 1994 agreement. There was 2012's Leap Day deal, the 2018 and 2019 summits. These moments that seem to be genuine marks of progress and then for whatever reasons sort of fell apart or were set aside. My question is, you know, looking back at all of these moments, are there any common factors in this sort of repetition of failure that we should be thinking about analytically now, but also policymakers should be keeping in mind as they try to find a solution?
Well, that's a tough question, you know, because the world is very different today than it was in each of those instances. So, you know, I think what happened in each of those instances, or certainly in 1994, during the Bush administration, in 2012, was that the United States felt like it had the upper hand on North Korea. And that conditioned our responses in each of those situations where we thought we could use that upper hand to get the kind of deal we really wanted from North Korea. In 1994, we did get a good deal with the North Koreans. But in 2012, you know, that fell apart and the Obama administration missed a chance afterwards to reclaim the deal. And then, in the Trump administration, the summits failed in part because Trump thought he had an upper hand and wasn't willing to be flexible enough. Uh-huh. So, you know, this idea that the United States can convince other countries to change their national interests, I think has been a theme that's run throughout the decades. And today, maybe again, it will be a theme for President Trump.
Well, especially post-Cold War, when, you know, we in the United States are at the apex of our national power, having come out of the Cold War victorious. I think there's this sense that, you know, North Korea, a country that President Nixon famously called a fourth-rate pipsqueak, how can we take them seriously? How can we treat them as sovereign equals? And I guess the North Koreans showed us at the end of the day, right? But Joel, I was going to ask you, you know, you seem to be of the opinion that another Trump-Kim summit is possible. Why do you think that? And what would have to happen to actually get us there?
Well, first of all, President Trump thinks it's possible. Secondly, Kim Jong-un has at least hinted that it's possible, but he doesn't want to discuss denuclearization. Third, Trump's going to be in Seoul the end of the month, and a lot of people are thinking, gee, he's going to be in Seoul. We could have a repeat of the DMZ summit in 2019. So all of these factors may point to another summit, but you know, I'm not saying there is going to be one. It's created a lot of speculation and there's a lot of smoke, but we don't see any fire yet.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, we're in a very similar place to 2017. Kim's wrapping up a military modernization five-year plan that's supposed to wrap up by the end of the year. They're heading into the Ninth Party Congress of the Workers' Party in January. I mean, my thinking, and I'd love for your reaction to this, is that the Ninth Party Congress is really what I'll be keeping an eye on. I mean, if Kim's going to do what he did in 2018 and say, look, our five-year plan was a huge success. Let's hear out the Americans. That'll be the moment to do it. But alternatively, he could continue to just triple down on the relationship with Russia and China, which given the optics of the last couple months, I mean, this parade in Pyongyang, of course, the parade in Beijing, where he was alongside Kim and Putin, Xi and Putin. I think I'm open to kind of both of those outcomes. What do you think is going on when it comes to how Kim is kind of viewing what's going on with his relationships with Russia and China versus the longstanding desire that North Korea has had for a different relationship with the United States?
Well, look, I don't see him as reaching out to the United States as an alternative to Russia and China. I think that's going to continue. I think he's going to reach out to them with his own objectives this time, not as an alternative to Russia and China, but to see if he can get Trump to make a mistake. And by that, I mean, I think one of the things Kim could ask for is for Trump to withdraw U.S. troops from the Korean Peninsula. I think it's quite possible that will come up because it's come up in the past. And, you know, nowadays, that would serve Kim's interests. He wants to strengthen his position in the region and strengthen the position of his allies. Very different from 2019, when he was serious about reaching out and establishing a close relationship with the United States. And he wasn't that close to China or Russia. So there's a different geopolitical goal here.
I think that's a really prescient thought, that the geopolitical situation has shifted since 2017. But I want to get back to one of the sort of overarching sort of conclusions or one of the parts of the book that I clued into when I was flipping through it, is that, you know, you write that of the six U.S. presidents that have dealt with the North Korea issue, Barack Obama and Donald Trump probably are the most responsible for where we are today. I kind of want to dive into that a little bit more, but mostly because it reflects to me, at least, sort of this oscillation in U.S. politics has also been reflected in the longevity of certain foreign policy aims and initiatives. You have sort of the switch from Clinton to Bush, and then Bush to Obama, and then to Trump and Biden, and then back to Trump. And so, you know, do you have any sort of thoughts on the linkages between domestic U.S. politics and foreign policy making and how that has played out in the context of North Korea policy?
Well, you know, under the Obama administration, and I talked to lots of people, and domestic politics never came up, really. The big issue was, you know, the Obama administration, and particularly the president, thought it was a lost cause. The deal with North Korea. And that's why they adopted a a policy of what was called strategic patience. And over time, they realized that that wasn't working. And even in the second term, the president became very frustrated with that policy. Hmm. And they searched for a different policy. They did policy review after policy review and couldn't come up with anything different, in part because they all were so used to strategic patience, they couldn't think out of the box. So, that was the problem. And only at the end of the administration, during the last year, did the president say, look, we've got to do something about this. And they couldn't come up with something in time. Hmm. And that led to his meeting with President Trump in the Oval Office, where he warned Trump about the danger posed by North Korea. In Trump, I don't see domestic politics as being a big factor either. Mm-hmm. He was on his own trajectory. And of course, he was strengthened by the fact that there was a lot of support, at least among Republicans, for what he was doing. And he didn't care what anyone else thought about that. So, there were blips on the screen in terms of Congress and other people. Certainly a lot of people criticized Trump, but he didn't really care that much about that.
What about the Bush administration? Because, a lot of people talk about the final months of 2002 into the first months of 2003, confronting them about the covert uranium enrichment program that wasn't operational, but that they were planning on bringing online, the NPT withdrawal, the U.S. decision to invade Iraq. For me, at least, that seems like the point of no return for the North Koreans when, they fundamentally, I think under Kim Jong-il, that's like, they come out, they start talking about they have a nuclear weapon, they have physical nuclear deterrence. How do you sort of think about that period? As an exercise in alternate history, if, let's say, instead of blowing up the agreed framework, the U.S. had tried to talk to the North Koreans about the uranium enrichment program, could we have maybe found a different path? Or do you think it still very much is a function of the U.S. invading Iraq, naming the North Koreans part of an axis of evil that irrevocably changes how the North Koreans think about their ability to coexist with the United States without nuclear weapons?
Oh, no, that was an important point in history. You're absolutely right. The fact that the Bush administration blew up the deal, that was a big development. And the other fact is the North Koreans were willing to negotiate about, fixing the problem of uranium enrichment. And it wasn't something that Bush discovered. We knew about it in the Clinton administration. We were watching it going on, and we warned the Bush administration about it, but it didn't do anything for a couple of years. And the problem got worse and worse and worse. And, when the United States sent a special envoy to Pyongyang to talk, and as you know, Pandit, Ankit, that ended as a disaster. The North Koreans turned around and said, well, we're willing to talk about this, but the Bush administration wouldn't talk to them about it. Still, I think the North Koreans were willing to negotiate even into the beginning of the Obama administration and beyond that. And there's lots of evidence to suggest that.
I have one final question, a very easy one, obviously. When you are thinking about next steps and sort of the future of this particular issue, you had mentioned sort of the inability of the Obama administration to not think outside of the box. How can policymakers today think outside of the box, given all of the current constraints in the U.S. government in particular, but also on the geopolitical sort of stage? Where is that creative thinking happening, and how can it get sort of injected into this problem, which is frankly existential? Nuclear weapons are not something that we should be joking about.
Well, that's a great question. And, it's hard to figure out where thinking takes place in the Trump administration, particularly on Northeast Asia. If we had talked a month or so ago, I would have said a Trump-Kim summit would be a big mistake. Hmm. you know, now I see what's going on in the Middle East, and it sort of makes me think, well, maybe there are places where thinking could take place. But, you know, the Middle East, Northeast Asia isn't the Middle East. And so what you're going to need is someone to sit down and say, look, you know, we can't just play the replay button on what we're going to do, and we need to shift gears. We need to shift gears to stop the bleeding in the near term, and, you know, wait for better days. And part of that is what we've discussed before, which is you can't insist on denuclearization, at least in the near term.
So what should policymakers insist on? If you could give them a recommendation, you know, what would be the list of the short list of items to really that can be worked on? If denuclearization is not sort of an item to consider, what are the items?
Well, you know, there's going to have to be something that at least stops the progress of North Korea's nuclear program. That's number one. And, you know, everyone knows what those measures are. There's test moratoria, for example. Mm-hmm. Number two, we need to think about different confidence building measures that can lessen tensions in the region. And that may entail restrictions on U.S. activities in the region that involve nuclear weapons. So those are two things. And then number three, if we ever get this far, you know, there's a lot in the agreement reached in 2018 between North and South Korea that lessens the tensions at the DMZ. So if it's possible to resurrect some of that, that would be great too. So all of these are not the big, you know, they're not big ticket items, but right now I think we need these kinds of steps to at least lead to that in the future.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, unless you've got any final questions, Ankit, I think that'll be it for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Joel. As a reminder to our listeners, Joel's book, Fallout, The Inside Story of America's Failure to Disarm North Korea, comes out on October 28th. So make sure you get yourself a copy. Thanks for listening to The Diplomat's Asia Geopolitics podcast. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you don't miss out on future episodes. You can now also watch these episodes on YouTube if that is your jam. Feel free to get in touch with Ankit or myself with episode suggestions or questions. We'll be back soon with more. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Katie.